oscillator, but you're making it 10 dB stronger than the strongest RF signal you ever intend to accommodate. Within the diode mixer itself, that very strong local oscillator, typically plus 13 dBm, in the doubly balanced mixer, you could assume it's being converted into a perfect square wave inside of the mixer. You could assume that. And if you studied that mathematically, you'll come up with all the correct answers. You're putting in a sine wave because of the diode action, and you're saturating the daylights out of those diodes. On the positive half of the sine wave of your local oscillator, two of those diodes in that ring are saturated. You could say the diode at 130 and the diode at the 730 are the two being saturated. On the other half of the sine wave, the diode at 1030 and the diode at 430 are being saturated. So you're alternating which of the four diodes, two at a time, are going into saturation, depending on the polarity of the LO. You study it from that point of view, and you realize the hold-on circuit, let me drop. The hold-on circuit is acting like a double-pole, double-throw switch, which can invert polarity, and it's inverting the polarity of the RF signal at the local oscillator rate, as if a pure square wave was doing all the switching action. That's what's really going on inside. And boy, can that do magic. And that's what it's doing when it's receiving. You'd be amazed what magic you can do that when it's transmitting. By using a properly chosen doubly balanced mixer as an on-off switch, I was able to generate 10 gigahertz pulsed signals that had a pulse duration of 250 picoseconds, a quarter of a nanosecond. Each individual pulse consisted of three sine waves of 10 gigahertz. You try to build any kind of a pulsing network that can give you RF pulses where each one of them is a quarter of a nanosecond long. 99% of the time, everybody you go to is going to say, impossible. If you're smart enough to use a modern-day doubly balanced mixer, probably $30 worth of hardware, you can do that. Properly used, so those things can do magic, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW.
AC2IS here. Okay, hopefully one last question here. You said the local oscillator should be 10 dB higher than your RF input signal. I'm wondering, is that at least 10 dB higher, or is that optimally 10 dB higher? And then would it be optimal to do something to detect the amplitude of your RF signal and then adjust your local oscillator to be exactly 10 dB higher? AC2IS.
Each doubly balanced mixer has a very small range of local oscillator power over which it gives you the best possible performance. The majority of passive doubly balanced mixers that you and I can buy, made out of diodes, want something in the vicinity of plus 10 to plus 13 dBm of LO power. You give it that precise amount of LO power, you'll get maximum performance out of that doubly balanced mixer. If you decide to give it plus 20 dBm of LO power instead of plus 13, at first it'll behave like a charm, but you might burn it up. If you decide to give it a lot less than plus 10 dBm, it'll give you medium performance, but you won't get full dynamic range. If you want the full dynamic range of the mixer, least amount of insertion lost, least amount of undesired products, best amount of mixing linearity, the majority of doubly balanced mixers want to see something in the vicinity of plus 10 to plus 13 dBm of LO. You could starve the mixer and give it a hell of a lot less LO, but you better also be putting in some DC bias on those diodes to partially turn them on in order to try to come back to good performance. So there's an ideal local oscillator power range you should meet, and your manufacturer will tell you where that most desirable power range is. When you do that, you're giving it the strongest signal you can without overheating the diodes, and you're giving the maximum saturation for the ones that are on. Let me drop. And you're not exceeding the peak inverse voltage ratio for the ones that are off, and you're not overheating the network. So if you want best performance, give it the right amount of LO power that's on the data sheet for that doubly balanced mixer. Over to you, Bill, K2LIW.
K2IS here. Okay, so I misinterpreted something you said earlier then. So you're saying that it should be plus 10 dpm, that is 10 dB above a milliwatt, and not 10 dB above RF signal input. Is that right, AC2IS?
There's a yes and a yes to that. If you're willing to use the right kind of excessive bias network, if you want to run the mixer in a starved LO mode, you can put less LO power into it, but now you're also going to supply some partial DC biasing to partially turn on those diodes so that you still get good action with your weak amount of LO. And when you're doing that, make sure that the local oscillator is still 10 dB stronger than the signal you're putting into it when you're running it into the starved local oscillator mode. So for a whole bunch of reasons, make sure the RF is never within 10 dB of the LO. And if you're not willing to use the starved biasing techniques, starved LO techniques, I strongly recommend you put in the right amount of LO power unless your back's against the wall. Over to you, Bill, K2LIW.
AC2IS here. Let me see if I've got this straight. Optimally be at the manufacturer recommended power for the local oscillator, which is likely to be plus 10 dBm, but definitely be above 10 dB above your RF signal, preferably much more above that. Is that correct, AC2IS?
Yes. Don't allow the RF to come within 10 dB of the LO, otherwise your mixer will give you another kind of nonlinearity. The diodes in there are a kind of very specific desired nonlinearity that does the mixing action. The diodes being saturated and turned on and turned off sequentially by the LO signal. That's a desirable operation. As the RF signal gets within 10 decibels of the amplitude of your LO signal, another kind of undesired mixing characteristic start taking place. One way of looking at it is that the diodes are turned off at every instant of time. Two diodes are on and two diodes are off in this four diode network. As the RF signal starts getting too strong, the off diodes start turning on when they shouldn't be turned on, and you start getting other effects that are undesirable. Over to you, Bill, K2LIW.
AC2IS here. So if I'm interpreting you correctly, we're both saying the same thing. Make sure that the local oscillator is, quote-unquote, well above 10 dB of the RF input. I think we're both saying the same thing, AC2IS.
Until you start using these starved mixer techniques, you're going to be putting in the desirable amount of LO, which typically is plus 10 to plus 13 dBm, unless you buy a high dynamic range mixer, which uses more than four diodes. You start putting multiple diodes in series on each one of the four corners, so to speak. So if you're using a typical mixer, plus 10 to plus 13 dBm is a typical requirement for LO. Make sure the RF signal doesn't get too strong. Keep the RF, my example of plus 10 to plus 13, make sure the RF never gets as strong as 0 dBm, and you'll be happy. If the RF gets to 0 dBm and stronger, you will start becoming unhappy. Over to you, Bill, K2LIW.
Gotcha, okay, so I might want to put an attenuator on the input if the input is too strong, and that would be the better way to deal with that rather than trying to adjust the local oscillator. Okay, but still, whatever method I'm using to keep the two apart
story, but you've got the headlines. And if you start making investments studying doubly balanced mixers, you'll discover it's a very useful component. If you're ever going to be building transmitters, receivers, superheterodyne circuits, mixer circuits, pulse generating circuits, image phasing mixers, doubly balanced mixers, properly used, can do an awful lot of magic. That very simple looking network, as a schematic diagram, consists of four diodes and two transformers. And the secondary winding on two of those transformers have got a center tap. Properly wired, that thing can do a lot of magic. You can buy a doubly balanced mixer, which can tolerate on the RF port anything from, let me pick a number, 10 megacycles to 18 gigahertz inclusive. The LO port can take anything from 10 megs to 18 gigahertz inclusive. And the IF port can take anything from 0 to 100 megahertz inclusive. A good modern-day doubly balanced mixer can do all of that. That's a lot of magic. Over to you, Bill. K2LIW.
Thanks, Dick. AC2IS here, and just an FYI, I'm part of a group where one of the guys has decided that he wants to plot the IQ output of an SDR radio, the hardware part of an SDR radio. So that's something that I'm kind of trying to lean over his shoulder and help with a little bit. I think that's all my questions for the moment, so I'll be on the side. AC2IS.
Roger, Dodger. Yeah, to try to plot the linearity transfer characteristics of an INQ system, and by the way, what I've described is the block diagram technique for doing INQ in the old days. Nowadays, you buy the right integrated circuit by way of a Gilbert, by way of a Gilbert-like circuit with the right assemblage of transistors. You can get all of this action in a software-defined radio, even though you won't see those diodes and you won't see those transformers. The equivalent is there. With the right kind of op-amps and digital circuitry, you can do this. So plotting this performance could be a lot of fun. Okay, anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above? And John, are you there? KC2WGB? K2LIW listening to anybody. Okay. By now, Cosmos, which started at 9 and went to 10, it's over. So I guess you guys are getting tired. If there's no further discussion on any subject, we might end early tonight. K2LIW listening.
WB2BXL, try again this time on the computer. How you doing, Dick?
Very fine, Frank. I called you about four times earlier, but maybe I didn't wait long enough for you to come through. Over to you, Frank.
That may have been the problem. I'm on an Echo Link. I was also using my tablet, and that may have added additional latency. Problem may have very well been on my end. I'm not certain, Dick. In any case, I don't know if you heard that we lost a member of the technical group on here at the Kings County Radio Club. Have you heard that yet, Dick? Go ahead.
Negative. I did take a quick look at my emails, and if that was a QST announcement, I didn't see it, or at least I didn't see it up until 7 o'clock tonight. So who did we lose? And I may not be familiar with all the people in Kings County. Over to you, Frank.
No, unfortunately, Dick, you did know, meet this ham, I believe, several times at Field Day, Tony, Whiskey Whiskey 2 Whiskey, died suddenly Saturday night. I just got an email from Howie into GOT, which went out to the LIQRP group. I don't know if you're on that list, saying the wake is on Staten Island Tuesday night and the funeral mass is Wednesday morning. You probably remember Tony. I believe he was one of the guys who sat up with you all night at Field Day a couple of times, a couple of years ago at Floyd Bennett Field. Go ahead, Isaac.
Yes, I think I do remember Tony. Tony and also Mel and I think we're up to the wee hours of the morning discussing cabbages and kings. Was this an expected loss, or was it a sudden loss for Tony? Over to you, Frank.
Absolutely not expected, to the best of my knowledge, Dick. Howie may know some details, but to the best of my knowledge, this was in no way expected, even though those of us who know him well know Tony had some health problems. Best of my knowledge, absolutely not expected. He lost his mother last week, which makes this like really doubly tragic for the family. Go ahead.
Frank, give me a very rough guess as to what you believe Tony's age was. If Tony was 50 years of age, we would say this is terrible. I know Tony wasn't 80, but if he had been 80, we wouldn't feel quite as bad, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Frank, K2LIW.
He was closer to 50. He may have been just 50. I'm not 100% sure, but he was around 50. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, I can remember when I was 20 years old or 18 years old, living in Middle Island, Long Island, fixing people's television sets, and I remember running into a person who was 52 years old or something like that, who told me, please fix my television so that me and my wife could watch the soap operas. It's the only amusement we have. Our children are out of the house, and we're sitting here waiting to die. At 52 years of age, when I was 18 or 20, it did sound very old. And what they were saying almost sounded reasonable to me at that time. Now that I'm well above 50, I can realize how crazy that statement was. And it said that these people didn't find themselves a hobby, if you know what I mean. And some of our friends have lived to a ripe old age, that they're a little bit careful with their health. So that is too bad. What was Tony's favorite band? Was he an HFer or a VHFer or all of the above, Frank? WB2 and VXO, K2LIW and the TechNet.
Tony was really a ham's ham. I think he was everywhere, so to speak. He built QRP stuff. He operated QRP. He lived in an apartment, but it didn't discourage him. He went and took his QRP stuff. Or even, I think, on occasion, 100-watt radio. I think he had an Icon 735 at one point, though. I'm not certain. Out at Cannonball Park and sat there and did his HF ham radio. I remember him running out into the park with his HF set, with his homebrew QRP set to get on the air during the blackout of 2004 because he figured he'd have less competition and be able to make some good contacts without competition from everyone else in New York who was off the air because of no power from the mains. So go ahead.
Yeah, that's very crafty. Yep. I don't think he has signed into the TechNet very often. Now, you've signed in more often than he has. So it sounds like, was he also on 2 meters? I know that you guys, I think it's on Thursday night, where you, where the Kings County Radio Club gets together on their repeaters. Am I correct in the, did I remember correctly what Mel told me on Thursday night when I think you guys get together on 2 meters. Go ahead.
It was officially Tuesday night, and I believe still is, though I don't live in Brooklyn full-time anymore. That's why I'm at Echolink. I'm actually at my wife's house in northeast Philadelphia most of the time now. If I had a decent antenna, I could probably actually work the repeater via an RF path. In any case, Tuesday nights, I believe, are still the official net, though some of the guys probably got on Thursday night also. And, of course, Sunday morning, especially when Mel was still around, they used to get on, I think they still try to get on 10 meters. In fact, I think Howie and Tony talked on the 10 meter net every Sunday, probably until last week. Go ahead.
I understand. Are you more of an HFer or a VHFer? Which is your favorite portion of the spectrum, Frank?
I did a lot of HF operating for about 30 years until I dismantled my station at my parents' house probably about 8 or 9 years ago. Now I'm pretty much only on 2 meters and on Echolink and get on HF on field day. But I probably worked about 200 countries with wire dipoles and ground-mounted vertical when I was active on HF. Go ahead.
Of all the wire dipoles you've ever put up, Frank, have you ever worried about the conductivity of the wire of the dipole? Some people do at first. And you eventually realize that anything you make your dipole out of, other than nichrome wire or carbon granules, is going to work. So there are people who have made dipoles out of 30-gauge wire and 8-gauge wire. And the difference between the two is rather small. How are you, Frank? K2LAW.
I'm not afraid of that. Not at all. I mean, wire is wire. Copper wire was copper wire. You use copper wire for antennas. Never really thought twice about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, there are a fair number of guys who have made invisible dipoles, stealthy antennas, where the landlord won't let you put up an antenna, and they used enameled 30-gauge wire, which is dark to the color, and unless you're very sharp with your eyes, you don't see the darn thing. And sometimes they've used buttons as insulators, dark-colored buttons, so 30-gauge wire can make a pretty good antenna. You may not be able to survive a kilowatt into it, but the diameter of the wire is a very minor factor when it comes to, let's say, a 80, 40, 20-meter dipole. It's not until you start doing other things like a fan dipole or a double conical that the bandwidth starts expanding and the electrical performance changes. The number of wavelengths of diameter of the wire is so small that when you look at the Brown and Woodward curve of impedance versus length versus diameter of a monopole or a dipole. Let me drop. You're in the 1,000-to-1 or 10,000-to-1 ratio when it comes to diameter versus length or diameter versus wavelength. And so they all behave the same. 30-gauge wire or 8-gauge wire, very, very close. The only thing wrong with 30-gauge wire is it doesn't have as much physical strength. And you're probably not going to hang a piece of RG8U from it, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Frank. K2LAW. And 2APG.
I didn't take the space bar firmly enough, I guess. In any case, like I said, never really thought very much about that. I mean, I probably will at some point try to do an invisible antenna here at my wife's condominium. There are a bunch of other things to consider, like running coax around the apartment and stuff like that. But anyway, That's probably the sort of thing I'll have to do here. For 10 meters, I think I can actually tape it under the parapet of the balcony, which is about long enough for a 10-meter dipole. I'd love to do that at some point. I thought it would be a hoot to do things like low-power PSK-31. That other one, 64, a JT-64HF or something like that. I thought those things would be a hoot to do with low power from a condo, don't know when I'm going to get around to that. Go ahead, Dick.
Does Joe Taylor Modes, K1JT, the digital techniques, got a lot going for him. Dave, N2APG, what do you want to add to all this? You got it, Dave.
Yeah, hi, Dick. Good evening, N2APG. Didn't want to screw up your current QSO topic. I just had a couple of questions and comments about the Witness to Roswell book.
Yeah, the later version, you were guessing that it was published in 2012 or something like that. A little bit disappointed that the so-called, revised and expanded edition has a publication date. I think it's 2009. I'm looking for the page that's going to tell that to me right now. Okay, there's the page, 2009. But still, the main thing that I got out of my revised and later edition is that, let me drop. These two guys eventually interviewed 600 residents of that town. In many cases, it was the offspring of the original witnesses. In a fair number of cases, though, it was the original witness giving a deathbed testimonial. These people were scared out of their wits by the government intervention during that incident, and the government did such extreme things because at the time they were capturing the hardware. We were in the middle of the Cold War, and they didn't know whether or not that was Japanese equipment, Soviet equipment, or whatever. They wanted to have their own private time to analyze the equipment, and so they scared the daylights out of the residents. In some cases, they literally took their houses apart, making sure that the resident wasn't hiding some of the captured material under the floorboards, and they weren't very friendly about putting the guy's house back together. So they intimidated the daylights out of those people. And some of those people, because they were threatened by having their family harmed or having their pensions removed if they talked, that intimidation worked so well that until a person was on his deathbed and making a declaration, he was unwilling to talk before that time. But some of those deathbed declarations had a tremendous amount of very specific equipment, exact names of people, exact titles of people, exact locations they talked, saw, done, and whatever. And when you look at the correlation of all of those experiences, you come up with a very common story. So, and the weather balloon story really doesn't hang true. You had three separate crash sites, three separate chunks of ground where something unusual took place, and one of those crash sites had a gouge in the ground 500 feet long with scorched earth along the side. No weather balloon can do that. On top of that, the story at the time was that this is a highly classified project of this high-altitude balloon that's looking for either sound waves or radio or nuclear radiation from somebody else's test site. Well, if you're flying such a highly classified balloon that's doing that kind of work, you're going to be tracking it with radar, with telescopes, with people in vehicles, so that when that balloon comes back down, you're going to know exactly where it comes down because you know how high it goes up, how slow it comes back down, which way the wind is blowing. you're going to be there as it comes down. And so that Air Force person was ordered by his superior to give a report to the newspaper that a flying saucer was captured, and 24 hours later, he was told that it's a balloon and changed the story, and these people collecting the hardware showed up 3 days later. You mean if you're tracking your very valuable, let me drop, you're tracking your very valuable, highly classified piece of hardware, and you don't even know where it's going to land, and you're going to show up 3 days later to collect it? Something's wrong with that story. It's 2APG, K2RIW.
K2RIW and 2APG. Yeah, it's a very compelling read, and as you said, it just wasn't a weather balloon. Two questions, real quick. I have my book in front of me, and I'm looking from front to back. It's 256 pages. And I'm wondering how many pages is your book, if we can use that as a guide. I'm trying to figure out, is it worth looking for and getting a copy of the second edition? Does it have a lot more stuff in it, or is it pretty much about the same? So mine has 256 pages in it. I'm wondering if yours has, say, 356 pages in it, or about the same, or, you know, whatever. And the second question, let me drop it.
Mine has 318 pages. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, so yours has roughly 50-some-odd pages, more than mine. Okay, that's good. And the second thing is that if they did, in fact, recover remains of aliens and spaceships and stuff like that in 1947, that's more than 60 years ago. Do you find it believable? Is it possible that in those 60 years since they've had spaceships and aliens, no one else has come forward to talk about experiences, contact with the material in those 60 years? In other words, we have these stories from 1947, but we don't have anybody coming forward and say, oh yes, in 1965, when I worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, I saw the alien bodies. We don't have any of that. Do you think that's possible, if in fact they do have this stuff?
Yeah, there have been a few of those, Dave. And by the way, an awful lot of the reverse engineering was done by the Battelle Institute, which is an institute that's often required, or often hired as a contractor to do reverse engineering of very fancy equipment. So Battelle did a lot of the reverse engineering. There have been a small number of stories of people who did see the subsequent hardware, but they are also sworn to secrecy and intimidated like crazy. They're going to lose their pension, and their family is going to be harmed if they talk. And as I said, there were a few who talked anyhow, particularly on deathbeds. So the extra pages include some of that, and there is reason to believe that fiber optics, we got a great big leg up on fiber optics by doing reverse engineering. We also got a great big leg up on what happens when you use much higher refined titanium with other metals mixed into it. You get the so-called memory metal. And so we did apparently make some breakthroughs by way of analyzing the hardware. I'm having trouble believing that the residents of the spacecraft, let me drop, were they really captured alive, and did they live very long, and did we get a chance to interrogate them? There, I think the story is a lot more difficult to understand what did or didn't take place. Over to you, Dave.
Well, from what I gathered from my read of the first book, there were at least four that were taken into custody. At the time they were discovered, three of them had already passed away, and there was one that was very critically injured. And not long after that, the fourth, the one that was critically injured, did also pass away. And one of the one of the phrases in the book was that we killed him, basically, trying to help him or whatever, that we actually wound up killing him. So I don't know if that's, you know, how accurate that is. But it sounds like, you know, he might have been the survivor, probably was very seriously injured and probably was going to succumb to his, you know, his injuries anyway. But that's what I got out of it, that there were four, and one was still alive, supposedly was moving.
Yeah, I don't have good memory of that section of the book, what happened to the beings captured. And if you did capture beings from a far off place, how do you know what conditions are ideal for them? What temperature do they like? What humidity do they like? What air mixture do they like to breathe? What food do they need? I mean, to try to determine what's required to sustain life for them, if you're hit with that conundrum without a lot of a priori knowledge, that's going to be very difficult. For us to assume that their eyes are equally sensitive to the exact same wavelengths, they want the exact same amount of light, heat, humidity, temperature, food, air mixture, to assume that what we've got is exactly what they want, you got to be pretty arrogant to assume that their conditions and our conditions are that identical. So whatever conditions we've got could probably make life for them very uncomfortable. That's a guess on my part. ODU Dave, K2RIW.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Now, I am curious about your statement that other people have come forward with reflections about stuff after the 1947 date. In other words, the book that I read basically has recollections from the 1947 event, but nothing after that. There's nothing in that book that's after 1947. No one in that book says, oh yeah, 1955, you know, I worked on spaceship material. Doesn't say that in my edition of the book. So you're saying in your edition of the book, there's more recollections and things after the initial recovery date?
WGB. Hey, John. Yes, without a doubt. The later edition talks about the people who saw the material that was temporarily stored at the Roswell Army Airfield, and the people who were guarding the material and what they saw. It also traces the next step. The material was transferred to Wright-Patterson. It then talks about the Battelle Institute, roughly what they were paid, how long they studied the material as an outside contractor, and some of those people being interviewed. So there is significant amount of contact with the beings, contact with the material, beyond the original incident of July of 1947 in Roswell. Hey, John. Let's see, I guess we've only got 10 minutes left, and whether or not you think that the guys who will benefit from the mailbag are awake. And I guess they could benefit by way of the website playing it back at a later time. It's your choice. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Nick, I just walked in the door, although I was able to monitor the net on the HT that I had with me. In Jersey, I had pretty good reception there. But so I had to tell you about this job. Three lawyers, and it's going to court. Oh, they're going to have fun with this one. But I heard the net, and very nice.
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried, John. So you produced this particular piece of electronics for a particular customer of yours, a client, and that piece of electronics created an injury, and now somebody is suing. I'm making up a story, John. Over to you, John. K2LAW.
Ooh, there's a whole lot of people who are going to be suing. This is a dye and pigment factory that I was at Friday, where they had their 10 mega VA transformer, which was 2 weeks old, explode. And they had a backup, but it damaged some of the production equipment when it happened, and they were out of production for a couple of days, so, you know, they want to get paid for that. They saw my photographs, and that's why I was called, because I had to give them an explanation of what it meant. And they saw the photographs, and wow, were they upset.
Were you being interviewed by the plaintiff or the defendant? Over to you, John.
Well, the attorney, there was a stenographer and another deposition guy there, and three attorneys. One was for the company that did the installation, one was from the manufacturer, and the other one was from the company, the dye manufacturer. So those three lawyers were going back and forth. It was a question of an error that was made in the installation that I discovered that caused the problem to exacerbate to the point where, you know, caused the explosion.
Yeah, in order for a 10 mega volt ampere, wow, that's a good size power transformer. I presume this is a substation we're talking about for the factory. And I'm guessing a transformer of that size has an oil bath cooling it with fins, and you and I would like to believe there was a relief valve so that if overheating took place, it's not going to burst the case, and I'm guessing some kind of wiring error occurred, which put differential current into at least one of the windings, creating extra heating, and the overpressure wasn't properly relieved, and therefore the case ruptured, and all kinds of stuff got splattered around the building. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, John. Over to you, K2LIW.
And good evening to Dave, too. Yeah, about 8,000 pounds of oil wound up going into what was supposed to be the containment vessel, 150% containment, but they didn't have the valve closed, so it leaked out of the containment vessel. It's not PCBs, it's mineral oil. It's a fairly new, new transformer. What was happening was the CTs, which monitor the current, they have a couple of them there. Some of them run the ammeters that you look at on the panel, and the other CTs go back to what they call the CO, the control relays, the protection relays for overcurrent, undervoltage, and differential problems. What happened was photographs reveal that the jumpers on those CTs, which all CTs when they're shipped have jumpers on them, they connected the wires, they didn't take the jumpers off. But they did take them off on the ones that were for the ammeters. So it didn't detect the problem that was happening, and it just got worse and worse.
Was the transformer miswired, or was it being overloaded in the use that it was being applied to, and the metering didn't detect that overload? Over to you, John.
Perfect question, Dick. The transformer, my opinion, transformer failed due to the manufacturer, but it would have shut down if the CTs were hooked up properly, the wires were connected over those jumpers across the terminals. That was not going back to the differential relays or the overcurrent relays. So, just stupid.
John, you're so close to the industry, you know all the slangs and I don't. Charlie Tango, CT, what does that stand for?
Those are current transformers. They're just a coil of wire that the supply line goes through that has a ratio of, say, 800 to 5. If there's 800 amperes going through the main conductor going through the center of this coil, it'll produce 5 amperes of current, which is connected to the CO relays or the protective relays. And they have the same type of CTs. They have, I think, 9 CTs altogether. And one group goes to the ammeters on the panel. And those were working. They could see the currents and all that. But the ones going to protective circuits were the ones that had a short across each one of the terminals. That's how they're shipped. Because if you don't have that short on there and any current goes through there, wow, you get killed.
Now, because the shunt was in place, does that mean that the metering which is supposed to monitor the current, was displaying zero. And if so, wasn't somebody alarmed by the fact that a loaded transformer seemed to have zero current flowing through it? Seems like there's a bit of a comedy of errors here. Over to you, John.
Well, good guess, but the fact was, on the panel, as you operated the controls, those meters were working because those CTs were hooked up properly. It's CTs that went to the CO relays, the protective relays, which are just ABB makes them. They're maybe 9 inches wide, 4 inches high, and all they have on the front are little adjustment buttons. There is a very tiny little LED on it, but nobody was paying attention to that. Nobody looked for that. They're not looking at those, they're looking at the ammeters. They thought everything was fine.
Was there a set of installation instructions telling you, well, do this and this when you install it, and the last step before you turn it on is to remove those shunts? Was there a set of instructions instructing that to take place? And the vendor who did the installation, did he sign off saying that he followed all the steps? Over to you, John.
Not only did the contractor sign off on it, their project engineer that monitored the installation signed off that it was done right also. But I've got photographs of those jumpers in place. Yeah. Normally what you do is, as soon as you start wiring, before power is applied, you take all of those jumpers off and then put the wires on. They're little number 12 wires that go on there. But, bad error.
Now, the overcurrent that was not being sensed that created an over-temperature, was that due to an overload? Because these jumpers that were in place that were supposed to be removed, it just means that the alarm circuit didn't get a chance to see the alarming condition. But what created the alarming condition in the first place, John? Go ahead.
There had to be a flashover in the transformer. The case of the transformer is quarter-inch steel. It's pretty heavy, and 8,000 pounds of oil. And you've seen windings of a transformer. It looks almost like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, only straight up. And the wires are wound around that, each coil. And what happened was, when it arced over, whatever it did, the coil separated, pushed the top of the transformer cover up a little bit, and broke the fitting where the oil pump is. There's fans on it also. And the oil pump was running. And it pumped all of that oil out in a couple of minutes into what was supposed to be the containment vessel.
It's good that there was a containment vessel. If not, I presume when the case ruptured, in theory, shrapnel could be scattered around, which could be life-threatening. Is that true?
Well, nothing separated away from the transformer. It was just bent out, flayed out. But the containment vessel is only about 18 inches high, and it surrounds the whole transformer. And that'll absorb more than 150% of the oil. That allows for some water if it's raining, things like that. But because the valves weren't closed on the containment vessel, it leaked into the building, all over the floor, all over their parking lot, went everywhere.
This meeting that you were at, where you've got both plaintiff attorneys and defense attorneys simultaneously interviewing you, it sounds to me like what they call an EBT, examination before trial. Is that approximately what was taking place?
Oh, absolutely. That's what it's all about. And to have those guys there on a Sunday, wow, somebody's got some big bucks.
And I'll bet you're... you heard some people doing some very careful wording. In other words, the plaintiff attorney was wording his questions in such a way to try to get maximum mileage that he desired. And I'll bet you the defense attorney gave responses and asked his questions in a way that would give him maximum mileage. I'll bet you heard some very fancy weasel wording. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, Dick, I'm sure you've been at depositions, and you know how they ask you the same question five different ways. Wow, yeah, very complicated, and trying to maneuver you. Yeah, they do try to do that, because all they need is a little crack in the door, and they'll push it open. So you got to be a little careful.
And there are times when the right response for you is, that's a logical sounding question, but under these circumstances, that's an improper question. The question was worded such a way that it presupposes condition A took place or existed, and that's not yet in evidence, and so on. In other words, there are times when an attorney will ask a question in a way where he's trying to create entrapment, and he's getting people to try to presuppose things that are not yet in evidence. I bet you saw some evidence of that. Is that true, John?
Oh, definitely. They were all trying to take the least amount of responsibility. But as I told them, there's two responsible people here. The people who made the transformer, they produced the transformer that failed, in my opinion, because the protective circuits on the output side were working perfectly. So if it was a question of a load, that would have opened up and protected it. Yes, the installer made an error on the overcurrent, undervoltage, and differential system. Yes. But it still would have protected the transformer if it was the user's fault. Oh, they didn't like that.
Of course, you personally saw the installation instructions, and you saw the line in the installation instructions where it said to remove the jumpers at this time, and was that step, did somebody check off that he did perform that exact step? Over to you, John.
Basically, that's a given. When you're told to install the CTs, that's normal practice. It's not written specifically, but they knew to take them off of the other six. Why didn't they take them off of that three? Those three. And the fact that I had the photographs, I didn't notice it until I looked at the photographs. I didn't even think about it when I looked at the transformer. But later on Friday in the evening, when I was looking at the photos, my nice big 8x11s, I saw them. And then I went back and looked at the transformer, and I says, well, this is one thing that's definitely not good.
Had you taken those pictures, John? In which case, my goodness, are you involved? Or was it somebody else's pictures that you were studying? Go ahead.
Oh, no, I took those Friday afternoon when I was there. Because the door that where the connections are made on that connection panel, there's a door that has a nice locking handle and a lock that goes on it and two bolts. That door was blown right open and bent.
And so you used your camera, and I guess by way of Photoshop or whatever, you made 8.5x11 prints. Out of curiosity, were these color prints that you made? And how many, John? Good job. Go ahead.
I took about maybe 50 photographs of the site and about maybe 20 of the transformer itself. And, yeah, I did the production. I have, it's very easy for me to do that. I just take my camera card and stick it in the printer and it prints them right out. Or I can put them on the plotter. The plotter does color too. And when I first saw them, I looked and, you know, I said, wow, I got to make these bigger. So that's when I did the full sheets. I mean, I can do up to 4 feet by any length in color.
Run that by again. You own a color printer that'll make what I call a J size. In other words, 4 foot wide by any number of feet long. You own a color printer that will do that. And by the way, is that a laser printer? Is that an inkjet? What in the world is that? That sounds like one hell of a piece of equipment. Over to you, John.
Yeah, HP plotters. I have two of them. One will do it in black and white. The other one is full color. And they are ink cartridges. Boy, do a nice job. And if you put a photographic type of paper, the shiny paper on there, you you can't tell the difference whether it was a darkroom job or the plotter.
That inkjet cartridge that goes into that plotter, there's got to be some bucks in that one, John.
Yeah, there's three color and one black, and they're $100 each for them.
And my guess is when you're making a print that big, you're not going to get a very large number of prints out of that cartridge, are you?
Well, I usually did drawings, and the drawings, because they're just line drawings, they don't take much ink, but a photo, yeah. I would imagine if I were to make two F sizes, let's see, I could probably make six F size before I'd run out of ink.
So a 4 foot wide by any length is called an F size. In the place I used to work at, they used to call that a J size. Go ahead.
No, the F size is like a 3x4.
Understand. And I presume that standard is way back in the days of blueprints that have to be folded a particular way and end up as 8.5x11. Is that true?
That's right. So they fit in a regular manila envelope. Yes. You got it. And you have to fold them in a certain way that your title is on the first sheet and folded in the right direction. You know, sort of like when you fold a letter and put it in an envelope, it's supposed to open a certain way. Same thing with the drawings.
Yeah, back in the days when I was making blueprints on a great big machine, I remember watching people do that. Fun stuff. Sounds like you've been hired to do a fancy job. It sounds like you're eventually going to be spending some time in court, John. When do you think that's going to take place?
Personally, Dick, I think they're going to settle out of court. I don't think they're going to want to go to court. I mean, it's obvious that the mistakes were made, so it'll probably wind up they'll eat half each, something like that. But how they're going to get paid for production problems, that I don't know. But it's going to be big bucks.
Has all of that oil sprayed all over the place stopped the manufacturing operation? And the lack of this power transformer at the substation probably also stopped everything. Is this factory going to be in the non-go mode for X number of days or weeks, in which case the total number of bucks can run up to a pretty big number? Is there any kind of a backup system in place? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick. They have two of these transformers. One of them was just replaced. That's the new one. But the problem was it damaged the factory elements inside when it arced over. So they had to make those repairs, which took them 2 days. So they were down for 2 days, and they were working high, at least two shifts a day. So I'm sure that's going to add up to a big number there. Even though they had the power available when they switched over to it, they couldn't run stuff. A lot of damage.
I presume this is a manufacturing facility. And be careful now. Are you allowed to tell us approximately what is the product being manufactured?
They make dyes and pigments. So they have grinding and powder mixing and blenders and presses and compression systems, that type of stuff, a lot of air operations.
Roughly how many employees? I think you said they're running two or three shifts per day. Good number of employees.
I think they have approximately, not counting management, I think there's approximately maybe 20 workers in the plant on a shift.
Yeah, from that you and I can make an estimate of how many dollars per week or per year flow through that facility. I presume it's been around for a number of years, producing a product that the people want. The product that they produce, do you think this particular factory has 20% of market share, KQLIW?
That I don't know, Dick. I know they make for many different companies.